Live from New York, it's The Gary Nall Show. And now, your host, Gary Nall.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Nall, broadcasting video streaming live from our studios in New York City. Today, this is a special press conference dealing with an important topic, on-the-air press conference with new revelations into the plot to kill Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. We will be taking at least an hour, possibly 2 hours. In the latter part of our press conference, we will be opening it up for you to be able to call in and ask your questions, offer your challenges to my guest. My guest is William Pepper. He is an international civil and human rights attorney based in New York, best known for representing Martin Luther King's accused assassin, James Earl Ray. In 1967, Dr. King had reached out to Dr. Pepper regarding an essay he had written for Ramparts magazine concerning Vietnamese victims of American napalm missions. He was present at Dr. King's famous Riverside Church speech. William was the citizens' chairman for Robert Kennedy's run for the Senate in Westchester County and also a counsel for Robert Kennedy's assassin, Sirhan Sirhan, arguing for a second shooter. William has received undergraduate and graduate degrees from Columbia University, a doctorate in education from the University of Massachusetts, a Juris Doctoral degree from Boston College, has studied at the London School of Economics and Political Science, and his most recent book, The Plot to Kill Dr. King, The Truth Behind the Assassination of Martin Luther King, was published by Skyhorse. In preparation for this special program today, we have spent the past 2.5 years in extensive discussion and reviewing the literature, reviewing the facts, reviewing the documentation that he has accumulated in order to come forth and make the accusations he is making. Anyone listening to my program over the many years, 40 years on our sister station WBAI and longer on WMC and WR, know that I do not invite people on the air to promote conspiracy theories. But I do invite people on who have done their homework and can present information that would qualify as being able to withstand cross-examination in a major trial. By our estimations and by his own calculations and his journals and his work diaries, William Pepper spent more than 35,000 hours doing his homework, more than 39 years. Quite simply, he has spent more time as a legal scholar studying the background of Dr. King's shooting than any other person on the planet. And he comes with an impeccable background. Nice to have you with us today. The public has been told that there was only one shooter, James Earl Ray, and that was it. Story over. But it's not. In order to appreciate the revelations you're going to be sharing with us today for the first time, I would like for you to give us the background with documentation so that the public understands no information we're sharing today is based upon hearsay, a second or third person innuendo. It must be based upon your own firsthand information, depositions, under oath testimony, so that we know that there is some veracity and validity to what you're saying. Tell us about why James Earl Ray was selected to be the fall guy. Who set him up? How did they get him out of jail? Let's begin there, please.
Thank you, Gary. Yes, the details of James's involvement totally have only emerged over the course of the last few years. Back in 1968, when Martin was killed, and I only knew Martin the last year of his life, as you indicate, It was because of the Ramparts piece. He came to me, and we became close during that last year. But after he was killed, James Earl Ray was named. He and eventually extradited from the UK. I thought they had the right guy. I thought this was the as you said, this was the end of the story. It was about 9 years later when Ralph Abernathy and I were in conversation, and he said, "I would really like you to come with me to the prison and interrogate James Earl Ray before me." And I said, "Ralph, I knew nothing about I know nothing about the case. I said, are you thinking that there may be something amiss there?" And he said, "I'd just like you to put him through the a type of interrogation that puts him under stress, see what happens." Anyway, we did that. We went to that prison in 1978, and I put James through 5 hours of very stressful examination. It took me several months to prepare for that interview. At the end of the session, we those of us in the room, which included the Reverend James Lawson, dear friend of Martin King's, Abernathy himself, Mark Lane, who was James Ulray's lawyer at the time, myself, and I brought a body language specialist from Harvard, Dr. Howard Behrens, to just sit and watch Ray as he was put under stress and how his how he moved and what we could learn from that. At the end of that interview, we came to believe without question, James was not the shooter. We didn't know what role he might have played, but we had no doubt that he wasn't the shooter. And that flowed from his total ignorance with respect to how that weapon was organized, how it was used, and all of that, and his own lack of acumen or ability in terms of using such a rifle. He raised so many issues in the course of that interview that while we knew he wasn't the shooter, we didn't know whether he was involved or not. It took me then 10 years from 1978 to 1988 to become fully convinced he was not involved in any knowing way. And as a result of that, I met with him several times in the prison. He kept asking me to represent him. I refused. I said, "I can't do this unless I'm convinced you were not a knowing part of the assassination." But in 1998, I took the case on. And in 1998, we then I took it to the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals, and we went to the Supreme Court, and of course we were denied at every level. There was a an opportunity to do a documented trial, an unscripted trial that HBO and Thames Television would put together with a randomly selected jury. That trial took 10 days in 1993, and it took the jury 7.5 hours to come back and find Ray not guilty. And that was on the basis of a minimal amount of evidence that we had developed up to 1993. The first book on this case came out in 1995. It was Orders to Kill. Then James died in prison in 1998. And the King family and I had become increasingly close on this issue of his innocence. And the family and I decided we would bring a civil action against one of the known local conspirators whom we had been able to put evidence together and deal with, a fellow called Lloyd Jowers. That case was tried in Memphis, Tennessee. Most Americans don't know it ever was heard, don't even know what the evidence was. Over 30 days and 70 witnesses in that civil action in Memphis, Tennessee, where the media moved out of the courtroom every time serious evidence was being presented, came back in when someone like Coretta would testify or Andy Young, but always were outside, did not cover that case at all. So most American people don't even know the extensiveness of that trial. But it took that jury 59 minutes to find that, in fact, there was a conspiracy to murder Martin Luther King, but that the major responsibility rested in agents of the government of the United States, the state of Tennessee, and the city of Memphis. Lloyd Jowers main named defendant on the case was very far down the line. So that developed an opportunity for more and more evidence to come forward. Every time there something like this happened, people getting close to the end of their lives who had information would come forward, and they would come forward. I appreciate the fact that you and are determined that evidence that back up allegations are very carefully looked at, and that they're not mindless hearsay types of conspiracy type information. And as a result of the way we proceeded, always it was we would try to put people under oath. We would try to depose critical witnesses and both film them and record them, so that we had that kind of record and that kind of transcript that you're looking for. The question about James that emerged even more recently, and Gary, I didn't intend to spend 39 years of my life on a case like this. This was a slippery slope. I simply couldn't let it go. I had to move a young family to England when things started to get very hot here, and my four-year-old was picking up the phone, hearing threats on his father's life. There was no way to raise a family, so I moved them to Cambridge. And the children were raised in, that first family were raised in England at Cambridge. So I commuted, they were there. But I didn't intend to have to go through what in fact has happened. What we learned about James, the roundabout way of getting to answer your question, is that he was profiled by J. Edgar Hoover at Hoover's request. The Missouri Department of Corrections looked for an ideal con who could be a patsy, and they identified James Earl Ray. James Earl Ray's escape was then arranged, and he escaped on April 23rd, 1967, and that escape was arranged directly by money provided from Hoover's office. The money was carried by Clyde Tolson, Hoover's number two, who was a frequent visitor to the Memphis area and the Dixie Mafia group that was working with details on the ground. $25,000 was brought in by Tolson and was given to Russell Adkins, who was the patriarch in that Dixie Mafia family. And that patriarch carried the money, drove to the prison, and gave the money to the warden to organize that escape. They probably met in November, December 66, as close as we can come to it. And the reason we know this happened is because Russell Adkins' son, Ron Tyler Adkins, who was then about 15 years old, went along with his father to the prison and saw the bag, saw the money, saw the delivery, and Ron Tyler was there. Ron gave an extensive deposition, which helped us in a lot of other areas with a lot of other information, because he would sit in on all of the meetings. He would bring the coffee and the donuts, and he just was privy to all of this. And his father involved him knowingly. He was taken to his first lynching when he was 6 years old. So he was very much involved in the Klan, and frankly in the cross-clan Masonic membership operations that went on, that were personified by the Dixie Mafia. So
it was his, just so we're clear, your witness that
yes.
you had testified for hours under oath,
yes.
his father ran the Dixie Mafia. He
yes.
was the godfather.
In that area, yes.
So he was first-hand witness to all those transactions
yes.
and meetings. All right.
He was present. And we put him through 2 days of sworn, intensive deposition, and kept coming back to questions he had already answered to see if there was any inconsistency. And he had no reason to lie. Ron Tyler Adkins is, in my view, a courageous young man when all this was going on. And now, of course, he's well advanced in age. But he had no reason at all to lie. He was not paid any money. He was not promised any money. He was wanting to get this off his chest, all of the things he observed and heard.
Would there be other people who, on their deathbeds, came forward to verify different facts that you would not otherwise have known?
Yes, there are other people who came forward.
And he's still alive today.
I'm sorry?
The son who
is still alive.
Still alive today. All right, go ahead. Please continue.
Yes, there were other people as well who came forward.
All right. Now you mentioned J. Edgar Hoover. Tell us why J. Edgar Hoover was a part of this. What was his position concerning Martin Luther King? Many people in the audience do not know the animus between King and Hoover. And then also, we now have, from Freedom of Information documents, tons of information about Operation COINTELPRO, MKUltra, where the FBI was up behind a lot of this, was aware of all of it, and actually infiltrated the entire civil rights movement. There was not a single civil rights activity that going on in the United States the FBI had not been monitoring or even had provocateurs in, but no one knew that they had infiltrated Martin Luther King's inner circle. I'm going to save that for the end of the program, not now, but tell us about Hoover's obsession with destroying King.
And it was an obsession. He hated Martin Luther King, and he was determined in any way he could to take him out of the frame. It's public knowledge that they put together a package of material incriminating, socially incriminating personal information about Dr. King, and they sent that to his home, and along with a note that indicated that his only recourse in light of any of the personal activities that they were alleging was to commit suicide. There was there was that kind of push that they tried to do. And what I've come to really understand is that political assassinations are a last resort as a rule. And it's very important, in my view, to put a political assassination like this one or these ones we talk about in the 60s, and I've not been involved in any of the others except as a defense counsel for Sirhan. It's important to put them in a historical context, because throughout history, when one looks at major changes that have taken place in domestic and foreign policy of various societies, very often there is a critical leader who is taken out if he's in the way. Martin King had gotten to the point where there was no other way to get to stop him from bringing masses of people to Washington who were going to approach their congressman and camp there, and no other way to stop him from opposing the war but to kill him. Now, H.L. Hunt, you probably know, was at one time the wealthiest man in America, major oil baron. Hunt was quite close to Hoover. He used to have a direct line to Hoover from a drawer in his desk. I know of all of this because his aide, John Currington, revealed this to me, provided me with documents, and so I know the closeness of Hunt and Hoover. And they often met in hotel rooms around the country. And Martin King was a subject of discussion. And Hunt was convinced that he could take care of him through his radio program and by attacking him over the radio. And Hoover's position consistently was, no, that won't work with this man. He will have to be killed. So Hoover was determined to kill him. What surprised me was the extent to which his number two, Clyde Tolson, was the man who came into Memphis all the time with the messages and the money. Clyde Tolson came in, and my chief witness on this was told to call him Uncle Clyde, even. And in this recent book, The Plot to Kill King, we have photographs of Tolson with the Adkins family. So he was a regular visitor and went away on trips with Mr. Adkins himself. Two of them took two transatlantic trips.
Let's keep this in perspective, because there's a lot of information. You're saying that the second-in-command of the FBI, who was also Hoover's alleged lover, Clyde Tolson,
yes,
was meeting regularly with the godfather of the Dixie Mafia. Most Americans know of the New York Mafia. They know of the Lucky Luciano and Meyer Lansky and the Colombo family. they rarely hear about the Dixie Mafia, but it was a very powerful mafia for that whole area of the United States.
That's right.
So he's going on personal trips with them. You could imagine if this were today, and the second in command of the FBI was going on a trip with the head of organized crime for a major city, that would immediately cause a scandal. So you've associated with people who are there, firsthand witnesses, including family members, that this all occurred. You're also explaining that J. Edgar Hoover had almost a DNA hatred of Martin Luther King and wanted him dead. And there are witnesses that you have that corroborate that he's actually said he's got to be killed, not embarrassed, not ridiculed. But before they tried to kill him, they set up a system where they tapped Martin Luther King's phones, followed him, read his mail, and found out he had some numerous sexual liaisons aside from his wife, and that they felt that since he could be embarrassed as a spiritual leader of the African-American community, embarrass him into killing himself. But that wasn't in King's nature. So then that didn't work, and we have proof that they actually did that. We have absolute irrefutable proof. That's no longer a myth. So now you're saying now they came to the plot, and it was Hoover who guaranteed this would be covered up. How did they prevent the media from doing any homework and digging into this?
Well, the media, the control, the consolidated control over mainstream media in America is something that has emerged over the years. And it was certainly, in its early years, it was certainly being developed back in the 60s. I could tell you the story of when I came back from Vietnam and I wrote the Ramparts piece. Bill Atwood, whom you will know of, was publisher and editor of Look magazine, asked me to come by and talk with him. And he wanted to do, in Look magazine, he wanted to duplicate, effectively use my photographs and my observations in a nationwide magazine piece in Look. So he wanted to talk to me about that. So I went into Look's offices, and he came up to me, greeted me, held out his hand and said, "Oh, you'll be pleased to know I had a visitor last week." And I said, "You didn't? Who would that be then?" And he said, "Averell Harriman came in to see me from Washington." I said, "Governor Harriman came in to see you? And what did he want?" "Well, he brought me greetings from the President of the United States. And he said the President had a favor to ask of me." I said, "What would that be then?" He said, "Well, the favor was that I would never publish or print anything that Bill Pepper wrote." He said, "Now, what do you think of that?" He said, "You're not even 30 years old, and the President of the United States is afraid I might publish something that you write." I said, "Mr. Atwood, I'm more concerned about what you said to Governor Harriman." He said, "Oh, I told him we were going to see you next week, and if we believed in what you were saying, we were going to publish. And give the President my best regards." Now, that was Bill Atwood, and one of the last of that breed of independent journalists. And I think they've disappeared pretty much from the scenes of our...
Seymour Hersh is still alive.
Seymour Hersh is still alive, yes. And Seymour Hersh has done some very good work.
Bill Moyers is still out there.
Bill Moyers is still alive, but Bill will not go into certain areas of Lyndon Johnson's administration.
No, because he worked for Johnson.
That's exactly the point. He was the press secretary.
Yeah.
But I think that the few and far between and the mainstream media today is very controlled. And they were not going to reveal anything of this sort that was going on, if they knew it.
Mix, now we're coming to an essential piece of the puzzle. Tell us about the day that King was shot. Tell us who shot King. And is that person still alive today? You met the shooter, correct?
Yes.
I had
lunch with the shooter.
So you're going to tell us who shot Martin Luther King. He's still alive today. How he got away with it. Who cooperated with him? Because this had to be a whole group of individuals.
Yes. Yes. The shooter of Martin Luther King fired from a brush, thickly covered brush bushes area behind the rooming house where James Earl Ray was told to go and where he was told to leave his bag of his belongings up on the second floor. The shot came from the bushes behind. The official story always was that it came from a bathroom window, but it didn't. It came from the bushes behind. The shooter was the best shot in the Memphis Police Department. He was a police officer. He was a Vietnam War veteran. He is still alive today. I did meet him for lunch. He wouldn't eat, but he sat through a lunch with me. And his name is Frank Strauser. And it's a name that is known among police circles in Memphis, Tennessee. And Strauser came to my attention way back in the early 2000s. He was brought to my attention by a black worker in the Memphis Police Department shooting range who was responsible for just cleaning and taking care of the needs of the people who were there. And he told me the story under oath of what he observed on April 3rd and April 4th. And it was that this man, Strauser, who was assigned to the shooting range, spent the entirety of the days practicing with what was described as a very special rifle, very special gun. And he was down continually shooting and shooting and shooting. And he was the same guy who had said at various times, when King comes back, he's going to get his head blown off. He was a racist of the first order, and he was obviously a part of an inside group that included a man called Earl Clark, Lieutenant Earl Clark. And for years, I thought it was Clark, who was also a very good shooter. I thought it was Clark who was the shooter, but it wasn't. It was Strauser. At 3 o'clock, a little after 3 o'clock on the afternoon of April 4th, my witness saw him go up to a car that he was going to drive, take off his overshirt, have only his undershirt on, and throw the rifle and the shirt on the back seat of the car and head off to downtown Memphis. Now, he did not see him fire the shot. He did not say anything about any allegation that he was there or he knew that. But he saw him practicing. He saw him continually working with that rifle. And he had no doubt that this man was the shooter of Martin Luther King.
That's supposition.
Yeah.
He has no way of knowing. That would be knocked down in a heartbeat in cross-examination.
Except for additional information.
Tell us that.
In the muddied area going between the rooming house and the area in the bushes where the shot was fired from, there were two large footprints. And they were taken and made plaster of Paris models of those footprints. They were very large. They were over 13 inches long. This is one aspect. When I met with Frank Strauser, at one point I had told him, I lied to him. I couldn't tell him who the witness was. I couldn't tell him who had given me the information and pointed me in his direction. I couldn't do that because I was afraid that they would kill him. So I lied to Strauser and I said Lloyd Jowers, who became the defendant in the civil trial, told me before he died that you were the shooter. Now Jowers was out there with the shooter, and Jowers took the rifle from the shooter and ran into the kitchen. That we all knew. We established that. And he broke it down in front of one of his former lovers. And we have details of that. And that's how we got Jowers. He was afraid that he was going to be prosecuted. So he admitted that, yes, that this is what he had done. But he didn't name Strauser as the shooter. But when I had to tell that to Strauser to keep to protect my witness because I'm afraid they would kill him. So I told him that, and he said, oh, He was taken a bit aback that Jowers would have said that. And then I said to him at one point, I said to him, "And what size shoes do you wear, Frank?" And then he pulled his head back, and he thought, and then he looked at me, and he grinned, and he said, 13 large. And this was after I had told him about the Plaster of Caris shoes. 13 large. Okay, that's fine. Again, it's just an incriminating fact, but nothing more than that.
That will not get anyone convicted.
No.
Thus
no.
far, you're still in supposition.
No. But then, further on, I had a street person who's known him for 30 years jump in the back of his cab one day and say, "I understand that you got a problem." "Well, what's that then?" "The problem is that Pepper's gathering evidence that's going to show that you were the one who shot Martin Luther King. And Joe Brown, who was a former trial judge in Memphis, was going to be running for district attorney general. He was coming back. He did a television program, one of these judging programs, Joe Brown. He was coming back in to run for district attorney general and had always supported our efforts in court." And so this fellow said to Strauser, "And you know, Joe Brown is likely to come back in here and win, and that's all that's required to start open an investigation and move forward against you." And at that point, he caught this man off guard, and he said, very quickly, he said, "What are they going to prosecute me for, something I did 30 years ago? Or," and he hesitated, "or knew about 30 years ago?" So that statement and that witness receiving that statement has repeated it and is in writing, and it has been documented. So I think it's fair to say that he has never admitted that he was the shooter. We had never had anyone who saw him pull the trigger and shoot Martin Luther King. But if you're asking me for an opinion on the basis of everything that I have gathered and how I observed him as I stressed him a bit, and from what Nate Whitlock, the witness, got him to say off guard, plus how he conducted himself after the assassination. He was a cop on the loose. They tried to get rid of him because he was running prostitutes out of his car, apparently. I knew one of his partners who said he had no use for any police regulations. He thought for some reason, and I never explained this to his partner, for some reason he thought he was untouchable. For example, Jim told me, for example, we were in South Providence. Somebody grabbed the woman's purse and was running down the street with it. And Jim said, "I said, look, I'll go this way. Frank, you go that way, and we'll cut him off." Frank said, "No need to do that. No need to do that." Pulled out his gun and shot him dead as he was fleeing. Was there when he went into a black bar where the jukebox was blaring because they were told to look into the killing of a particular resident in the area. He shot out the jukebox and said, "Now I want to get all your niggers' attention. I want you niggers to tell me which nigger shot this man that we're trying to find the killer for." So he said he had no respect at all, and he behaved very strangely. All of that's circumstantial, to be sure, but he apparently had really changed. And finally, they did force him off the force because it was becoming a bit of an embarrassment. Okay, so that is as much as we know about that.
All right. How I would frame this, and I apologize for the N-word being used. I understand the context you were using to make your point. What I hear you saying is that from the best evidence you have, your personal observation is that this individual you're alleging was the shooter. You have a person that took the weapon from him, supposedly, but never identified him. But there was another person that you did interview under oath, and that person talked about getting the weapon, breaking it down. A witness to that event saw how the weapon was given broken down, and you have footprints, you have a different ballistic range of where it was in the bathroom, which been up, but it, rather it was from hidden behind bushes further down, and that this person was a rogue individual with allegations of shooting the person, the black person in the back, shooting up a place, and allegedly running a prostitute out of his car. That still is a circumstantial position. Strong as you may feel it is, there is always opportunity in a court of law that you would lose that. But there's also an opportunity for jurors listening to that to also bring back a guilty verdict. But you've laid out a piece of your puzzle, and that's what we want, looking at the best information you have. Point two, you're suggesting, from the research you've shown me prior to this interview, that Martin Luther King did not die once he was shot, could have even survived those wounds, was killed later, and you have a witness that told you how he was killed, who killed him, where he was killed. This is really important to know that everyone thought Martin Luther King was shot and died. That's what the news media,
that's what we all thought.
The coroner's report, everyone said that. You're digging into this, you come up with another story. Please now lay out the story from the time King was shot until your witness says that he was finally pronounced dead.
Okay. Let me back up a little bit and give you some history about what I'm going to tell you. The family doctor for the Dixie Mafia family, Russell Adkins' family, was also the chief of surgery at St. Joseph's Hospital. The son of the of Russell Adkins, the Dixie Mafia leader, who sat in on countless meetings involved with the planning of the killing of Dr. King, was present at a meeting where this doctor, his name is Breen Bland, B-L-A-N-D, Dr. Breen Bland, was chief of surgery at St. Joseph's, where this doctor told the father, and they were talking about the killing of Martin King, he said, just make sure that they take him to my hospital, not to John Gaston, where often people with bullet wounds and knife wounds and violent victims were taken. Make sure he comes to my hospital. Because if for any reason he survives or is surviving the bullet wound, we'll make sure he doesn't leave the hospital alive. Now, that's a separate conversation that this witness had.
And you interviewed that witness?
Oh, under oath.
Under oath, okay.
Yeah, as part of a deposition.
All right.
Okay. Now, years later, a young man was uncovered. We found him as a witness. Was the son of a surgical nurse at St. Joseph's Hospital. Lula Mae Shelby. His name is Jonathan Shelby. Jonathan is blind. He's been a victim of diabetes. He's not been a well man. And he agreed to be deposed. And Gary, all of these depositions are filmed as well. So he agreed to be deposed and to be filmed and to tell what he knew about the actual assassination of Martin King. His mother was a surgical nurse, and she was in and out of the emergency room where they were treating, working on Dr. King. He was still alive when he was brought into the hospital and into the emergency room. He had a catheter in his throat to enable his breathing, but he was alive. At one point, the chief surgeon came into the room with two men in suits, and he ordered all of them, everyone, to leave the room. He first said, stop working on that nigger, and let him die. And then he said, now all of you get out. And he chased them all out of the room. And as she was going out of the room, she heard the three of them, so she assumed, because she was backwards to them, gathering up saliva in their mouth, like that. And that caught her attention, so she looked over her shoulder, and she saw the three of them spit on the body of Martin King.
And he was still alive.
He was still alive. They saw him spit on the body of Martin King. The catheter had already been pulled out from him, so he had no life support.
She saw this.
She saw this. And then she saw the chief surgeon take a pillow and put the pillow over his face and head until there was no longer any breathing. Now, she saw that. Now, what happened was, she was not allowed home that night. They kept everyone there. There was a huge military presence also in that hospital. They kept them there overnight. She came home the next morning, and she gathered the family around her in their living room, and she was in tears. And she said, I can't. Why did they have to kill him? She said. Why did they have to kill him? And then she told this whole story of what she observed.
Was she African-American or Caucasian?
She was black. She was African-American. Okay. She told this whole story. And he remembered it. All of these years he remembered it. And this is the story that he recounted on his mother's recitation that morning and her shock. So, on that basis, it appears clear to me, in my opinion, this young man had no reason to embellish or lie about this. It appears to me, on the basis of the previous conversation with a separate witness present, and this account of what appeared to have happened with a separate witness, so we have now two supporting this notion. It appears to me that Martin King was assassinated in the hospital. Now, Dr. Breenbland is no longer with us. He's gone. He's passed away. But would he have survived his wounds? I had two forensic pathologists look at the file of the injuries, and one of them is Cyril Wecht, whom I've known over the years and worked very
closely. I've interviewed him. He's very respected.
Very respected man. And Cyril said to me, Bill, he probably would not have survived his wounds, but there's no way they would have known that. If he's being treated and he's still breathing, there's no way they would have known that. Even though he probably would have died because the bullet did nick his spine on the way down. So that is the answer to your question.
Okay, so I would have interviewed anyone else who was in that room, the family members, just to see if they recall the same story being told. That would have been important if there's
no one else available.
No one else available. All right. Again, I apologize. If you wouldn't use the N-word, I'd appreciate it. Just, you know, we understand what you're saying, and we understand the significance of stating it as it was used at that time. But just for the sensitivity and sensibility of this discussion, I appreciate it, and the people listening. Now to the next piece of our puzzle. So now you're alleging a shooter, other than James Earl Ray, a breakout of the prison by Clyde Tolson taking money to the head of the Dixie Mafia, who took it to the prison, and they worked to make sure that James Earl Ray was able to escape, because this was not a prison, from what I understand, that people escape regularly from. And he was not particularly the brightest guy in the block, so it's highly unlikely he would have been able to have done that. And also the people who were firsthand witnesses to the conversations, what occurred, and also the hatred of the motive behind this. A couple more important issues. One is, that there are allegations that the FBI had infiltrated Martin Luther King's inner circle. And that is a piece of the puzzle that has never been fully explained or discussed. Could you discuss these allegations?
Yes. Martin King was to have had a barbecue dinner that evening at the home of the Reverend Billy Kiles, the local pastor, who had a relationship with SCLC in Memphis. He was not very active or contributive, but nevertheless he had a relationship with them, and he had invited the SCLC group, including Martin and Abernathy and all of them, to his house for this barbecue. The barbecue was to take place as early as possible after 6 o'clock. Kiles knocked on the door of Martin King's motel room at 10 minutes to 6. We know this because we have the police surveillance files, and at the civil trial, I had the officer who had them had that balcony under surveillance, I had him testify from his notes that he made. And yes, Kiles knocked on the door. The door opened slightly, opened for a few seconds only, then closed again, and Kiles walked down the balcony and just stayed there with his hands on the railing down the balcony. Martin King came out a few minutes later, just before 6 o'clock, and of course he was then standing alone on the balcony and was shot at 6:04. I always, over the years, wondered why Kiles never came back and stood alongside him as a part of a photo op, which he was known to do. But he didn't. He stayed far away, number one. Number two, throughout his professional career, he lied continually that he was in the room with Martin King the last half hour of his life. It's a matter of public record. He's told the story how he was there. He helped him pick out a tie. You know, they had preacher talk, as he said. Total lies, total fabrication. How do I know that? I once raised this with Abernathy. Abernathy said, Billy Kiles a liar. He's not in the room. You know, so it's not only the police records that showed he's in the room. Abernathy was right there with him, and Abernathy said, no, he was never in the room. The son of the Adkins, the mafia, Dixie Mafia leader, used to see the bags with names on it that contained money that various informants were given for information that they were expected to provide on the movement of Martin King.
Who was that?
The son of the Dixie Mafia guy, the same witness who rode in the car to the prison.
So whoever the Dixie Mafia was paying off as informants?
Yes.
And there would be money in a bag, and it would have their name on it.
There would be money in brown paper bags with the names of the people on the bags.
All right.
At Tolson would bring the money in, and they would be paid on a regular basis. Now, it's important to understand historical perspective here, because I think there's no question that Russell Adkins and this Dixie Mafia group had done many other jobs for Hoover and had a working relationship with Hoover historically. Carlos Marcello, the mafia boss in New Orleans, was up there frequently as well and was very close to Adkins. So the Dixie Mafia group were like a subgroup of Marcello's larger mafia organization. They were very close. They all benefited, right? And the old man, Russell Adkins, didn't appear as a known mafia leader. He was a city employee in Memphis who kept a very low profile, but he was what his son called, he was a fixer. Because of the connections he had, he was able to fix things. And he built a house for his hired killer. He had a guy who did nothing but kill people when he wanted them killed. And the guy's name was Chess Butler. Built him a house. Chess Butler, as it turns out, was the guy who killed the taxi driver who saw Earl Clark coming down over the wall I don't want to confuse the situation, but after the shooting, a number of people just before the shooting saw activity in the bushes, including a New York Times a journalist who was there, Earl Caldwell, saw these people moving in the bushes. After the shooting, the spotter is what Earl Clark was. The spotter came down over the wall and ran up the street to get into a waiting police car that took him away. A taxi driver who had pulled in to pick up somebody at the motel saw this guy coming down and saw him running up and was clearly an eyewitness to this. Well, he had to be killed, and he was killed that night. Chess Butler is the one who killed him.
How do you know? What's your proof?
The proof is the son of Adkins was out with his mother and the two Butler children at the Butler home when Chess came back in and said, yeah, I had to kill that taxi driver. I killed him, and I dumped the body on Route 55 or 51, and that was it. Now, what happened? That taxi driver disappeared. Nobody knows what happened to him. I have another taxi driver who interviewed him at the airport where he was driving somebody, and the guy told him the whole story. I saw the guy coming down over the wall. And then the police moved in to take his story, and they took the story. This taxi driver, the second taxi driver, Louis Ward, also under oath, Louis Ward, I never saw him again. And when I went back into work, he was a part-time driver, and I asked where he was, they told me, he got killed that night. And that's all. No more details about it. So this was just one aspect of a cover-up. And Adkins, Chess Butler, apparently did it. Ron Tyler Adkins, the son, sitting there on the bed near the kitchen, heard him admit that he was the killer, that he did take care of this one. So, I don't want to confuse the flow of facts here, but these are all events that.
So they had a plan B. If anyone was a witness, they had some inside the family shooter that would take him out.
They had to do that. They would take him out. Now we've pointed to Hoover on this, but it's very important to understand that back in 1995, I became aware of the backup military snipers who were also on the scene, and they did not kill Martin King, but they had two targets, Andrew Young and Martin King, and each of them had a sniper, and they came out of Camp Shelby, Mississippi, and they were put in their positions, and they were, as far as they knew, they were there on orders to kill Martin King and Andrew Young. And
what's your proof?
Two of them thought there was a cleanup operation going on in the early 70s and fled to Mexico. A former naval intelligence operative named Steve Tompkins, who was also an assistant to the governor of Tennessee at one point, did a year and a half long study on the involvement of federal intelligence against civil rights movements going back to the early King family. In the course of that article that he wrote for the journal, for the Commercial Appeal, he was ordered to cut it to one article rather than a series. And in that one article, there was a tiny reference to an Alpha 184 sniper unit that was in Memphis on that day. And nobody knows why they were there or what they were doing there. And he didn't say anything more about it. I went to him, and I effectively harassed him and told him, look, I got an innocent man in prison. I need your help. Will you travel to Mexico, where he told me these two shooter and the spotter had gone? Would you travel there? I'll pay your expenses. I'll pay their expenses. And will you ask them questions for me about this? So he went made several trips there and interviewed them. And what I have just said to you is what came out of Steve's interview with these people.
So you're saying that a person that you met with agreed to go to Mexico to interview two people who took themselves out of the United States, who were in Memphis, one was going to kill Andy Young, the other Martin Luther King. Did they say who gave them the orders to kill?
Sure.
Who?
Well, I mean, the head of, John Downey was the head of the 902nd Military Intelligence Group. That's the only MIG that's in the Pentagon. And John Downey was the colonel brought in to take it over in June of 1967. John Downey pulled their names from a list. I've got the whole list of... Steve gave me all the documentation of the whole list of that group that trained at Shelby, and
you realize that it wouldn't be J. Edgar Hoover going to them. It would had to have been
definitely wasn't Hoover.
It would have had to been someone either in the White House or someone in the Joint Chiefs of Staff, someone very high up, and would have had to give them that order.
The head of the Assistant Chief of Staff for Intelligence. Was it General William Yarbrough. Yarbrough ran that operation. Now, they had a liaison officer. They had a liaison assigned to Hoover. And how much they told Hoover or they didn't tell, I don't know. But it has emerged to me to be clear that this was they were there as a backup operation. Martin King was not going to be allowed to leave Memphis. If the civilian or policeman shooter on the ground didn't do it, the military would. And when Steve said, "Well, what did you think when you heard the shot?" He said, one of the snipers said, "Well, I thought, I thought the other guy shot it too soon. He didn't even think of the guy on the ground. I thought he shot too soon." But what we learned subsequently to all of this was that Downey had also sent two PSYOPs photographers onto the roof of the fire station, and they photographed everything. They photographed, one of them took the balcony, the other took the parking lot, back into the bushes, and they had the photographs of the sniper. And we interviewed those two photographers.
And what did they say?
And they said it was definitely not James Earl Ray.
So, hold on, this is very important. Yeah. This is brand new. In all of our discussions, you've never mentioned this to me.
Much.
All right. So you're saying that in case the Memphis police didn't kill him, that the PSYOPs group would, professional snipers, and that this was a backup plan, and that they actually had all this photographed, and they photographed, they would then have had to have photographed who was there. They would have had to photograph three people, the snipers, plus the guy who actually did the killing.
Yeah. But remember, the Alpha 184 snipers were not the photographers. The PSYOPs photographers were totally separate from the shooters.
And you interviewed them, and they have this as a matter of record. Where are those photographs at?
Yeah, well... We started negotiations to buy the photographs. The photographs were taken, were sent back to John Downey in the Pentagon. He had them. But we learned that one of the photographers who had moved to Costa Rica had a set of the photographs.
Have you seen the photographs?
I've never seen them. I started negotiations through Steve Tompkins with that guy. Steve made a mistake. He traveled to that meeting under his own name. And as he pulled up at the meeting, there was FBI surveillance on him, and a guy in the passenger seat of the FBI car stuck out this big long lens camera, and he spooked the photographer. Who just then threw up his hands and just said, "I'm not dealing with you. I can't trust you." And so that broke off our chance to get those photographs.
You realize how important those photographs would be today.
Terribly important.
Would you have seen James Earl Ray in the photographs?
No. Oh no.
Right. So you would have had three people that you would have seen with rifles. That would be it. Well, you're telling us those photographs still exist. Those people are still alive. That's a part of the story that my hope is that there will be journalists today who will come forward and work with Mr. Pepper, Wayne Pepper, who's sitting here in our studio on this exclusive press conference on who killed Martin Luther King. He has done over 35,000 hours of research. He has depositions. He has sworn statements. He has video depositions. He has the transcripts of trials. All of this now is a matter of public record. And my hope is that this goes forward. You're certainly not going to have any governmental agency investigated. They'd be complicit. They cover things up. They don't open them up. And also, you were mentioning the inner circle, the allegation that it's your personal belief that King's inner circle were also working, some of the people were working with, that would have been the local Dixie Mafia, it had been the FBI, because the money came from the FBI. And therefore, the FBI already knew who its informants were. We also know that there were more. This came out in the church hearings. There are more than 1,200 members of the media who were actually giving information to the CIA and other federal agencies during the 1960s and 70s. We also know from information from court depositions and Freedom of Information Act request documents that there were lots of informers inside and provocateurs inside the civil rights movement.
Yes.
So it makes sense that they would try to get close to King. Your allegation is that this is one of the people who were there who knew it. It has not been adjudicated. It has been proven. If any of the people, by the way, who've been mentioned by name on this program feel that what my guest has said is inaccurate and you wish to come on this program and to present your side of the issue and to challenge him, you have an open invitation to do so. We are going to do the following now. We are just at 1 hour of this, but I believe it's important that you have an opportunity to call in and ask your questions. If you're watching on the Ustream channel, I'm the only one you can see because only one of our cameras in studio is able to function. The other one is a professional, one of my professional cameras. We have a cinematographer filming Mr. Pepper. We will stream this shortly, and we will also include the actual documents. So when he says he has a transcript, we will roll out the entire transcript. We will roll out the documents, so you'll see these for yourself. Many people that he's mentioned are still alive today. None of them have recanted their statements. He has tried to get corroborating evidence, which is one of the first things you do if you're doing legal work or journalistic work. Is it more than one person saying something? What's their motive? If they have an opportunity to lie, what would be their motive for lying? Are they telling the truth? What do they risk by telling the truth? What do they gain by telling the truth? It was much like in the death of John F. Kennedy. One of the people who came forward to tell the truth did so only on their deathbed, and they gave this story to their son, who then came forward. Do you know who that was? Someone died not too long ago. In fact, person you know, Mark Lane, died just about a couple months ago.
Yeah.
And he wrote a really important book on this, and there was a movie made on his book about JFK assassination.
Yeah.
E. Howard Hunt.
Oh, right, Hunt's son.
Hunt's son.
Yes, I remember
when he literally was dying on his bed, he brought his son over, and he told his son the whole story. Now, we have later corroboration about what happened with JFK from a person who had in-depth knowledge, just Danny Sheehan. But we're not talking about any other assassination aid but JFK, or but Martin Luther King. So what we're going to do now is we're going to open up our lines for you to call in and ask your questions of my guest, William Pepper. Our number is 888-874-4888. 888-874-4888. We're going to take a brief break, come back, and we will go to part two of our program to have you ask your questions, offer your challenges. When we come back, I'll also mention a very important program we'll be doing on the Progressive Commentary Hour tonight at 7 o'clock that you won't want to miss. Back in a moment. Please stay with us.
There's too many of you crying. Brother, 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 there's far too many of you dying. You know we've got to find a way to bring some loving here today. Yeah. Father, Father, we don't need to escalate. You see, war is not the answer, for only love can conquer hate.
You know we've got to find a way
to bring some love and get here today. Oh, picket lines and picket signs. Don't punish me with brutality. Talk to me so you can see. Oh, what's going on?
Nice to have you with us, everyone. I'm Gary Knoll. Yatrice Lead, who is normally heard at this time, will be back on tomorrow. We're doing a special, in-depth press conference on the air, new revelations into the plot to kill Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. My guest is William Pepper, international civil and human rights attorney. He lives in New York City, best known for representing Martin Luther King Jr.'s accused assassin, James Earl Ray, who in a civil trial was found innocent. And he knew King during the last year of his life, and he worked with the King family a great deal. He has multiple degrees from Columbia University, University of Massachusetts, Juris Doctoral degree from Boston College, and degrees from studied at London School of Economics and Political Science, and is the author of The Plot to Kill King. And he has spent over 35,000 hours on this. And we've tried to separate out that which is evidence that is strong enough to withstand cross-examination in a trial. We've also highlighted that which is alleged, or where it's his personal feelings, so that you can distinguish between the two. And now it's your turn to call in and ask your questions. Our number is 888-874-4888. Let's go to Glenn Martin. Glenn, your turn.
Hello.
Hi.
Can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
I want to, first of all, compliment Mr. Pepper and say what an amazing thing it is that he has done. It's a wonderful accomplishment. My question is, what do you, Mr. Pepper, think that an optimal result of all this research should be or would be? You know, you mentioned, I think, during the program that you didn't expect the government to open this up and reexamine itself or correct itself in any way. Well, what should come out of this? What would you think would be the best thing that we might do or that people might do that would make this research and this evidence significant?
Well, thank you for the question. And I think that we are caught in a bit of a dilemma because we went as far as we could go within the legal system and in an attempt to get a trial. We then, as Gary said, we then had a civil action where I represented the family of Dr. King in 1999, and that was not covered really by the media at all. So I think the best thing that we can hope for is that somehow, through honest and diligent professional journalists and broadcasters like Gary Knoll, try to get the word out and educate people as much as possible about what it is their government does and can do. And this is, of course, political assassination is where it was a very important factor of government action activity back in the 60s. Regime change, which has been the policy of government in our time, a terribly discredited, despicable regime change has also resulted in political assassinations, and the people are not aware of it. So I think to the extent that people like Gary can get the story out there, that books like The Plot to Kill King can be read and digested, and perhaps a movie can be done. There is a studio that wants to do the movie, but they're unable to get a director. It's a fascinating thing. The directors are being told by their agents, the controversy of this story, this matter, will ruin your career. And they've been enormously difficult to get a director for this movie. It's fully funded. They have everything they need, but they don't have a director.
Thank you. I appreciate your call. Glenn, let's say hello to Robert Morningstar. By the way, I might mention Danny Sheehan, he is a remarkable human. You know Danny, don't
yes.
you? Danny, there would not have been any Pentagon Papers published if it weren't for Danny Sheehan. There would have been no guilt in the Kerr McGee with his Karen Silkwood radiation poisoning case. He has been instrumental in so many cases. He recently, just on the show, talked about the Kennedy assassination. J. Edgar Hoover was right at the center of it. So it's not Hoover's first time at being a part of regime change. Let's say hello to Robert Morningstar, who is also a scholar in the field. Nice to have you with us today, Robert.
Thank you very much, Gary. It's an honor to be here with you and Mr. Pepper. I would like to ask Mr. Pepper, first I'd like to remind him that in November of 1997, I had a young English lady deliver to him personally in London a copy of the Miltier files, a transcript of the Miltier dialogue with William Somerset, in which this scenario for assassination of the victim on a veranda across from a hotel was explicitly described as a tactic that was going to be used on President Kennedy. And 5 years later, the exact same plan was executed on Martin Luther King. The question I have deals with the switching of the rooms. For this plan to have worked, the room that was initially assigned to Dr. King on the ground floor was changed to the second floor with the veranda with the sniper waiting outside. Do you know who changed the room?
I have an opinion as to who changed the rooms. I can give you the scenario if you like. One of our witnesses that I mentioned earlier is the son of the Dixie Mafia chap and family, the Adkins family, who handled things on the ground. When old man Adkins died, his son, Russell Jr., came on and took over management of the operations, but in actual fact deferred continually to Frank Holloman, who was the director of police and fire. Holloman had spent a number of years in J. Edgar Hoover's office in Washington as an administrative assistant and was well trusted. Aside from incriminating statements that this young man heard Holloman making about the killing and how King should be, where he should be shot and all of that, the mother of this boy, who was the wife of Russell Adkins, received a message from Holloman through her son. And the message was, we have to get King, exactly what you said, we have to get King into an open air area where a decent shot can be had. Martin King was assigned to room 202, and you're quite right, it was a ground floor, secluded, secure, protected room. He had to be moved to 306 where he could be a target, a viable target. So the message came down to May Adkins, and she was told to get a hold of
alleged.
Well, she was, yes, her son was there, and he said that she received the message, and the message was that she should call a family. There was a black guy who worked for the family called O.Z. Evers. She should call O.Z. and get O.Z. to arrange for someone to visit the owner of the motel and to change the room. So he said she sent him to their outhouse, second house they had on the property, to get her husband's A book where he had OZ's number. She called OZ. And the young man was standing right, he was 16 years old at the time, was standing right there at the time, and OZ told her he would call her back. When he called her back, she gave him instructions as to what should be done and who should be asked to go to the owner of the motel. Do you want to get into that at this point?
Well,
because this man has raised that whole issue.
Okay, well, let us just put it in this context. What he is about to say now is his personal opinion. It is an allegation, and anyone mentioned will have the right to come on the program and to challenge it.
OZ, according to Ron Tyler Adkins, who was standing by his mother, at her elbow when she was talking on the telephone to OZ Evers, he said, she said to him very clearly, go and get Jesse. He was talking about Jesse Jackson. Go and get Jesse to go visit Bailey, the owner of the motel, and tell him to make the change. That is what we took under oath from this witness. And as Gary said, it was an allegation, and it has to be looked at as an allegation. And it is not that action is not confirmed by anyone directly, except, in fact, Martin's room was changed from 202 to 306. And, in fact, moments after Martin King was shot, I'm standing on room 306, Lurley Bailey, who may have been the person, she ran the motel, Lurley Bailey grabbed her head and said, my God, what have I done? And she ran to her room in the motel and locked the door. She had a stroke, was taken to the same hospital as Martin. She died 5 days later. Now, these are that's a fact. I mean, those things all happened. This other incident is, as Gary rightly says, an allegation. And, you know, I had known Jesse Jackson over many years, and to me it was depressing and shocking. But I had no idea, other than to have an opinion, that this young man had no reason to lie about those events.
Okay. Thank you, Robert. We're going to go through calls a little quicker. To get our lines are just blasting off the hook here. Let's say, and again, please make your statements, your questions, your challenges short. Let's go now to Matt in New York City. Your turn.
Actually, Gary, it's my art, the goddess of right and truth. Ancient Kemet. Thank you so much for this program. And Mr. Peppers, thank you for your courage and this story. I'd like to share that I'm very fortunate to be doing a book circle column for Black Star News and others under MAYOT, MAATOYA. So my first question is, how would I, I'd like an email or a way to get a review copy. Definitely want to review The Plot to Kill King. And being that, the last part of my question is, talk about the L.A. connection, and thanks so much for saving the spitting denigration story for Gary, because I did hear you on Coast. So explain that, why they couldn't use L.A. for the assassination. And in a time where a Republican talking head on CNN says Trump is the white nationalist faction of the party, would Spike Lee perhaps be an answer? and higher solutions for where we are at this particular serious time. And I'll listen over the air. Thank you so much.
There are a lot of questions.
Just first, how could anyone get a, who's a legitimate journalist, how could anyone get a review copy through Skyhorse?
Simply contact Skyhorse Publishing.
Their publicity department.
Their publicity department, yes. Lauren Jackson at Skyhorse Publishing, and I'm sure she'll get you a copy.
Okay. Let me mention also that tonight at 7 o'clock on the Progressive Commentary Hour, we're going to have The Myth of Human Supremacy. Derek Jensen, one of our nation's great environmental and ecological philosophers, an activist, and someone you almost never hear on the air, Diana Burchford Kroger, the Jane Goodall, the Force and Plant Kingdom, author of The Global Forest. She's going to be on. She's a scientist, biochemist, and Celtic sage. It's going to be a very deep topic about why we think we're supreme and we're really not. That's at 7 o'clock in the Progressive Commentary Hour. Let's now say hello to Maria from Baltimore. Hi, Maria. Oh, by the way, anything... I don't know what she was referring to about the Los Angeles connection.
I know what she's referring
okay.
to. Very, very quickly, it's my belief that the assassination of Martin King was initially to have taken place in Los Angeles. They sent James Earl Ray there. They kept him there for quite a period of time. The two snipers I mentioned from the Alpha 184 unit were also sent into Los Angeles and were kept there. All of a sudden, they were moved into the South, into New Orleans, Birmingham, and then, of course, Memphis. The reason, in my view, and it is only my view, that they changed from Los Angeles to Memphis was because there already was afoot the plot to kill Robert Kennedy following the Democratic Convention that was taking place there in June. And it would be very unseemly to have two political assassinations of this magnitude in L.A.
Just as they had originally planned on killing Kennedy in Miami, and when that didn't work, in Chicago. And that didn't work, then on that same trip. It finally caught up with him. At some point, I'd like to invite you back to discuss in depth the assassination of Robert F. Kennedy, and especially the fact that Sirhan was not the killer.
Yes.
He was there, yes.
Yes.
But he had been affected by mind control.
Exactly.
And I remember interviewing shortly, about a year after his death, Robert Blair Kaiser, who wrote JFK Must Die. And do you know Robert Blair Kaiser?
I do know of him. He died. He died recently.
Recently.
Yeah.
Yeah, so we'll do that discussion as well.
Yes, that evidence of Sirhan's innocence is stronger, in my view, than was the innocence of James Earl Ray's.
Okay, we'll talk about that in depth. Let's see, did we get to Maria in Baltimore?
Good afternoon.
Hi.
Yep. Again, to Gary and Mr. Pepper, a couple of questions. Do you think that Dr. Martin Luther King's inner circle was involved in this? I had heard rumors that Jesse Jackson was sort of suspect, and that Dr. Martin Luther King's wife, Coretta, never liked Jesse Jackson, but I never knew why. A second and last question, can you all make a movie outside of this country, of United States?
Well, the first question, I think I've answered in part with...
He has no concrete information, and we do not want... That's why I said we do not want to cast any aspersions against Reverend Jackson. It's just that what he did have proof of was what the son of the Dixie Mafia said based upon a call coming to his mother, and when he and his mother were together... with scrambling to get King into a different room. Fact. He was in one room, he was moved to another. Fact. That this man, and that's where the assassination occurred. But what role Jesse Jackson played or did not play in that, we do not know. That's where it's supposition. And until someone develops the story or until some evidence comes to the contrary. In this country, you must be considered innocent until someone has adequate proof to prove that you are not. And that's why I believe that we should leave it. Whatever Mrs. King felt about Jesse Jackson is irrelevant to this point. You can dislike someone. It doesn't mean that there is a legitimate reason for it, or if there may be a legitimate reason, it has nothing to do with the issue at hand, assassination. I'm sorry we can't do more than that, but I like to keep it right to what we can prove. Thank you. Dennis, your turn from New York.
Hi, guys. Thanks for a great show. In that same vein, it goes to that same issue, but I would ask Mr. Pepper to address the question of whether someone in the inner circle or somewhere else had Dr. King's local protection force, the invaders, removed from the Marine just prior to the assassination.
That's an interesting question.
Yes, it is. I interviewed every one of the invaders back in...
Explain who the invaders are.
Invaders were a black power group, a community-based black power group that were committed to providing food and educational tutoring and community services in Memphis, Tennessee. They were working with Dr. King. They had come and taken up two rooms in the hotel to help him plan the final march on behalf of the sanitation workers. So they were there, totally collaborating with him, totally working with him, and trying to work within the nonviolent parameters that he established. And that seemed to be going along very well. Then all of a sudden, on the day of the assassination, a member of the motel staff knocked on the door, and she said, I'm sorry, you're going to have to leave. And this was at about 20 minutes past 5, 25 past 5, somewhere in there. And she said, you're going to have to leave. And they said, what do you mean, leave? We're getting ready for this march, work with Dr. King. Said, I'm sorry, but we've been told that SCLC is no longer going to pay for your stay here in the hotel. And so you're going to have to leave. Well, aside from the fact that it was well past the checkout time and there would be billing for that room anyway, they were very perplexed as to why they were being ordered to leave immediately. And very annoyed because they thought things had been going along very well with Dr. King. And they said, one of the invaders with whom I spoke said, they asked her, who has given you this instruction? And she told them that the Reverend Jackson had given this instruction and that he was the one that was paying the bills on behalf of SCLC, and therefore he had the authority to make this decision. They then packed their bags, and they left in two cars around 15, 20 minutes before the actual assassination. Now, they were armed. They were a potentially obstructionist, unpredictable group, and they were removed.
Is it possible that they would have been with King when he went out on the terrace?
I mean, anything's possible. But I think what the fear was that because they were armed and because they were very committed community organizing type of people, that they might very well have come out with their own guns and fired at anyone who they saw was perpetrating that assassination.
Okay. Thank you for your call. Sweets from New York, you're up.
Hey, Gary and Mr. Pepper. Thank you for having this call. You said before there were bags of money with names on them. Who were some of those names designated to receive those bags of money on the inner circle?
This was the FBI. This was Clyde Tolson bringing it in, second in command to J. Edgar Hoover at the FBI for decades. And he brought the money in, and he was the one who gave the bags to the godfather of the Dixie Mafia. and then you can tell us what names were on those bags, if you know any.
I know the names on the bags that were given to me under oath by the witness, Ron Tyler Adkins, who saw the bags because his father let him have observation of everything. So I do know some of the names that were on those bags. But that is according, again, that is according to this witness. The other thing I have to make clear is there are two types of payments that were being made. There were regular payments that the FBI were making, much the same way in terms of the distribution, and then there were special payments that were brought in, as Gary said, allegedly were brought in by Clyde Tolson from Washington. The names allegedly on the bags that I've been given, and I do report this in both in the deposed testimony given under oath in the book and in the excerpt. One of the names was O.C. Evers, who was very close to the Mafia family and who worked for them on a regular basis. And another name on the bags was Billy Kiles, Reverend William Kiles. And allegedly, and I'm having to stress here that this is alleged, a third name that appeared on the bag that Ron had said he saw was the Reverend Jesse Jackson.
Okay, these are allegations.
They're only allegations.
Just allegations. Okay.
And I only have one, I must say, in fairness, I only have one eyewitness with respect to those allegations.
Okay. Sweets, thank you for your call. John from New Jersey, your turn. I'm going to take just five more calls, everyone, so please call in right now. Yes.
They answered several times my question about who was in the room. I heard on another program, I won't mention the name, but very much you would know. And he mentioned that members were told to leave the room. And I never got to hear the end of the conversation, who was the one that gave this order for them to leave the room. But I guess more or less you've answered my question, so give someone else an opportunity. Thank you.
Okay. Well, he did it. He's just told you who ordered the evacuation of the room.
He was talking about the emergency room, I guess. Is he in the hospital?
Yes.
Yes. Yes. That was the chief surgeon. Yes.
Yes. And the nurse, surgical nurse, who turned around after she heard them clearing her throat to spit on Dr. Martin Luther King, what she is alleging, and then put a pillow over his, took out the catheter, put a pillow over his face, and suffocated him. Let's say hello to Willie from Brooklyn. Willie, your turn.
Good afternoon, Gary. I don't know how to thank you for this. I've always had great respect. Yeah, you get for the work that you do. I love you, brother.
Thank you.
I really do mean that. Now, you know, what I'd like to say is this. Everyone who is listening to this, if you subscribe to any newspaper across the country, cancel it. It has to be canceled. If you don't do this, then you are just as guilty as everybody involved in this. The money and your television subscription also, because that money could be used to pay for PRN. Because this should be the voice. But I've always advocated that, the voice of America. And, Gary, I don't know how to thank you. I'd like to say it again, send this to everyone that you know, because I'm so hurt and I'm so angry, I'm actually crying. I thank you, I thank you, I thank you, I thank you, and I love you. Peace. I'm worried for you, Gary, because I know these people. You know what I'm saying? I'm really worried for you.
We can't hide if we know the truth. We have to stand up. The courage in this case is Bill Pepper, because he had death threats, had to move his family to England in order to not put them in harm's way. And I guess they never thought that it would come to this day. Because in this kind of story, if you have the FBI and the head of the FBI and the second command of the FBI working for you, if you have people inside the police department working for you, if you have the head of a mafia family working for you, and you cover your tracks, then there's very little opportunity for the truth to emerge. They just didn't figure someone would be as tenacious and as voracious in that tenacity as Bill Pepper. But he has. Now the truth today, at least what we know of the truth, as well as allegations, as well as suppositions, and well as personal opinions, are all coming forward. It is now up to other journalists out there to take this information and to see what part of it they can open up and how they can make multiple stories from this one story. This is a big story, and this is a historic story. Just imagine, we're heard all over the world right now. We have, this is a whole lot of people listening right now. Imagine if we could reach out to those two snipers who were in Memphis to kill King. Imagine, they're both still alive. Imagine if someone in this audience could get to them and get the photographs in a way that we could then bring their voice forward and bring forward those photographs. If you showed a photograph, are you kidding? That would make worldwide headlines. Especially, you could circle it with the high resolution qualification today. You can go right in and see who those people are. And then all the other evidence we have and all those depositions Bill Pepper could bring forward. Bill has done something unique. He has so many witnesses that have pieced together the puzzle. Do we have a complete puzzle? No, we do not. But do we have a whole lot more than what was originally there? Yes, we do. And so that's why I want people in this audience to realize, put that message out, and let's not let this go to sleep on us. Thank you for your call. Sharon from Connecticut. And then I'm going to just take three more calls. So if you want to be the last three calling in, I see Henry from Chicago. We'll take three more calls after that, 888-874-4888, 888-874-4888, and then we'll conclude our program.
What was the role of Lyndon Johnson, as far as you know?
I'm sorry, I didn't hear the first part.
The role of Lyndon Johnson.
Okay, William?
Well, it's my belief that nothing took place with respect to this assassination or most other events during his tenure that Lyndon Johnson did not know about. That doesn't mean that he had a hands-on involvement. I don't think that that's the case, nor was it necessary. But I think he had to be informed about this one. I think he was, without doubt in my own mind, because his mistress became a close friend of mine, and what she has told me in detail was that he also had a very serious involvement in the assassination of President Kennedy. But that's another story, and I asked Madeline to write about that at one point, and she did before she died. But she gave very graphic information about Lyndon Johnson's participation.
Lyndon Johnson was a very close friend of J. Edgar Hoover. In fact, they were both at the billionaire's estate in
Murchison
estate just before Kennedy died, the night before he died.
Absolutely.
And as was she. As was Mr. Hunt that you mentioned earlier.
Yeah.
So all the cast of characters were there who would play a part in the assassination, and they didn't get together to have a social. That's not what they were about. So it's highly improbable that, but not impossible, that J. Edgar Hoover would have conducted this assassination on Martin Luther King without discussing it and getting approval from Lyndon Johnson. They were very tied together. They were already tied together on the JFK assassination. Why not this?
Yes.
All right.
That's right.
Thank you for your call. Henry from Chicago.
Hey, Gary, how's it going?
Good.
All right. How you doing, Mr. Pepper?
Fine, thank you, Henry. Thanks for calling.
All right. I wanted to add this in regards to the allegations of, you know, Jesse Jackson being, you know, complicit in this. But a couple of years ago, a woman who claimed to work with Harold Washington said that she had a private conversation with Reverend Abernathy. And she stated that Abernathy said that there were only three people who knew Dr. King's schedule: Coretta, Abernathy, and Jesse. So when Reverend Abernathy mentioned that, I think he was kind of implying to her that Jesse might have been, you know, complicit in the whole involvement. So I just wanted to, you know, express that because she called in on a radio show here a couple of years ago about that. And it just stuck out in my mind when you had mentioned that.
Well, I wasn't familiar with what you just said. And again, anyone can call in a radio show. Doesn't mean what they're saying is true. You have to get someone under oath. You have to get them where they can support what they're saying with some form of evidence. What we have is we have now heard about six different references, five to six references of Reverend Jackson. We must remain in this position. These are allegations based upon people's personal recollections or their personal opinions. And if Reverend Jackson wishes to come on the show and to rebut these, he has an invitation to do so. So I thank you for calling in from Chicago, Henry. And let's now go to Alex from New Jersey. Alex, your turn.
Gary and Mr. Pepper, I just had one quick question, and I'll listen off the air. What role did the media play during the coverage of the trial? That's it, and thank you very much for this program.
All right, he did mention this. Maybe you didn't hear that part, but he said that every time there was an important witness giving damning information, the media would all go out of the room, and only when someone like Mrs. King was testifying would they come back in. But maybe you should go further in that. Did you ever speak with any members of the media and ask, why aren't you covering any of the important witnesses?
Yes, I Court TV was going to cover the trial initially, and I eventually spoke with one of their, and they decided not to cover. And I spoke with one of their attorneys, and was told no, it was simply not allowed from above. They were told not to cover it. These were instructions that were given always by senior editors or people of that sort. There was one local ABC cameraman, and I think he was a reporter as well, who insisted on staying and filming the entire trial. He lost his job. There's a long list of people who have tried to do the right thing, and they have been penalized. So it's unfortunate.
Let me give you an aside. I was once in Paul Block's office, who was a really nice guy, top producer. He was Johnny Carson's producer at the time, and I was doing Johnny Carson's show that day. And I didn't realize until I was there how long you had to rehearse before you did this little skit. All those things were not just spontaneous. And I was in Paul's office, and there was a call, and he made a comment, something to the effect that that's unfortunate because I really like Ralph. And I said, what was it? He said, well, I had to, you know, tell Ralph Nader, you know, not right now. We'll get back to you. But I've been told Ralph's not to come on. And so you never know when you hear someone say, well, we're just not covering that issue right now, or it's been kind of overcovered. It may have another whole different cause behind it. Now, that was just with Ralph Nader, who, in my opinion, my personal opinion, is the single most important consumer advocate in world history. He caused over 167 major laws, resolutions. Without him, there would be no environmental movement, which Rachel Carson created. This enormously brave marine biologist caused this movement with Silent Spring. It was Ralph Nader who actually gave it life, breathed life into it. And yet there was a time where you didn't want to go up against Ralph Nader if you're corporate America. And he had Nader's Raiders. And from that came Michael Jacobson and came a lawyer, I'm sure you know, a lawyer down in Washington, D.C., who was one of his major advocates, and Sidney Wolf, Public Citizen, and Turner, James Turner, the lawyer. And so whole movements came from that.
Yeah.
So the only way they could stop Nader was simply not invite him on the media anymore. And that's what they did. There was a whole drought where you just didn't hear or see Ralph Nader anywhere. And then you saw how the left and the liberal community treated him when he ran for president. And the narcissism and the conceit of the official liberal community is just, it's nauseating to me. It's nauseating. Why? And this is an aside. We have just a few minutes here. They said that Kerry should be the nominee, or separate from that, it should have been Al Gore. Both Al Gore and Kerry are both corporate Democrats. They're both corporate liberals. There'd been very little, except maybe a difference in the demeanor than if there was a George Bush. Same people behind them, right? Here's what wouldn't happen, probably never happen, if Ralph Nader were elected president. So this is for those people who say, oh, you cost us the election. No. If you would have voted for Ralph Nader, we wouldn't have had a 9/11, because we wouldn't have had military bases in Saudi Arabia and Kuwait and other countries that they resented, which was the primary resentment of Osama bin Laden and others of the Wahhabist view. We wouldn't have had a war in Iraq, wouldn't have had a war in Afghanistan, wouldn't be regime changing in Syria and Libya. Libya today would be the most prosperous, educated country of 54 countries in Africa. And we would not have had massive migration because of political carnage. We wouldn't be supporting the axis of real evil, Saudi Arabia, United Arab Emirates, Qatar. You could throw in a couple more, but we wouldn't be supporting that. We wouldn't have supported regime change in Honduras, nor tried to in Venezuela, and right now in Brazil. We wouldn't have been supporting NATO, probably wouldn't have a NATO today, which would be a good thing. We wouldn't have had NAFTA and GATT and the World Trade Organization, and we wouldn't have been supporting Trans-Pacific Partnership. We wouldn't have had a massive industry in hydrofracking and all of its pollution, because that wouldn't have been allowed. We had had long ago decommissioning our nuclear facilities and getting into sustainable. We wouldn't have had the labeling issue on genetically modified foods, because long ago those people had been put out of business. We wouldn't have had a bailout, because we wouldn't have supported taking too big failed banks and allowing them to walk free with over $6 trillion of our money. We wouldn't have had massive home foreclosures of over 30 million Americans. That's over almost 6 million homes being foreclosed on. We would have long ago had a living wage, and we would have had a different tax system. We wouldn't have a planet on fire, because we would have been engaged in substantial environmental regulation and keeping the Koch brothers and others responsible. That's just some of what we had had. Plus, we'd had universal health care. Everyone would have been treated for any condition, and we wouldn't have had massive bankruptcy. Just think about that for a moment. Think how many lives would be saved in the needless wars. How many people wouldn't be, you know, vagrants or looking for a place to stay or food to eat in their own countries. It would be a different world today if Ralph Nader had been elected. Yet try explaining that to the narcissist and the self-righteous who think that he was a detriment. The media participated in that. The media can demonize anyone, and they do. The media can take a William Pepper and make it look like he's, you know, just a delusional nut, and not allow him any opportunity beyond, because they don't want to touch this. Because today the media is owned by just 7 major corporations. They own 90% of all the media, magazines, even much of the internet. So that's why when you have an opportunity to hear the truth on a network that they have no control over, no influence, where there's no ideology and no dysfunction, pay attention, because you never know how long he'll have a voice out there sharing these insights, because we saw what they've done with other people before him who brought forward truths that they didn't want to hear. We'll just take two more calls. Vera from Brooklyn, your turn, and then we'll finish with Jerry from New York.
In this program for us today, and I would like to thank Mr. Pepper and commend him for his courage. My question is, does he know, or did he say, did he know whether or not who gave the order for Dr. King to go to that particular hospital where he was murdered?
I don't know. I mean, the St. Joseph's Hospital was a hospital that was reasonably close to the motel. I don't know who specifically ordered that he be taken there. And I don't think that Jackson necessarily had anything to do with that. I never heard, that he did. It was, I always thought just the routine. A routine decision because it was quite a close place to the motel.
But there was something you said earlier. You said that the chief of surgery of that hospital made a statement in the presence of a witness that you, that you must make sure that when if he's not dead, he goes to this hospital because that's a hospital where this surgeon was on the staff.
Exactly.
And that was very important. So he, and again, this is purely supposition, but the likely scenario from my perspective, which is that he would have told the police or someone in the police, this is where you get the body to go.
I think that's right. I think the word would have been given pretty clearly that that's where he was to go.
Yeah. But I don't think the ambulance drivers or anyone else at the hospital would have known this. This would have been directed body, to that location.
Probably the director of police and fire, Frank Holloman, would have been the one to coordinate that.
Okay. Thank you for your call, Vera. And finally, Jerry from New York. You're the final caller today.
Yes, hi. Great show, Gary. And I thank you and Mr. Pepper for all your work. I have two questions. Mr. Pepper, are you familiar with the work of Steve Coakley from Chicago? He spent many years delving into the real assassination of what really happened with MLK.
Yeah, no, I know the name, and I'm vaguely familiar with some of the work. Yes, but I don't know him.
Okay, and also you mentioned one of the names on the bag was within King's circle with Reverend Billy Kyles. If you go on YouTube, there is an interview with Billy Kyles where he, I guess, inadvertently admits that he did step back in order for the shooter to have a good shot.
That's an interesting story.
It's on YouTube. I mean,
Billy Kyles, on a couple of occasions, seemed to get carried away by remembering that moment and recollecting the moment when Martin King was killed. And somehow, as though he was transfixed or in another realm, said, "And I stepped back so he could get a clear shot." And I have no idea why Kyles said that. And when everyone hears him say that, it's startling that someone would make that admission, particularly when it's blatantly false, because he was down the balcony.
He was way down.
Way down the balcony. So I have no idea, he was trying to say.
Did you ever speak with him?
I have spoken with Kyles. We had Kyles as the defense of Lloyd Jowers at the trial called Kyles as a witness, and he had a very unhappy time as a witness, I have to say.
You can, and that brings us to the conclusion of our press conference on the air. All of the information that we have discussed, all the relative documents, the depositions in their entirety, not anything taken out of context. You can see everything, plus all of the letters are on file. They're also in the new book, The Plot to Kill King. And any legitimate journalist who would like a review copy can get it from Skyhorse Publishing, from the Publicity Department. And after our program right now, I'm going to continue filming William Pepper in our studio, which is in a different room, and we will try to put together some of the most interesting parts of this story with B-roll and historical footage, and as soon as we do, we'll put it up on our website for you to watch. Thank you all for listening. I'm Gary Knoll, along with William Pepper, the International Civil and Human Rights Attorney in New York. This has been a special presentation on New Revelations into the Plot to Kill Dr. Martin Luther King, Jr. Thank you for listening and watching.
Mother, there's too many of you crying.